from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! How the CIA manipulates news. We'll speak to a reporter who discovered how the agency placed propaganda directly on international news wire services, and a photographer who traveled through Latin America for a major U.S. photo agency finally pins down how the CIA combed through his negatives for intelligence information. Then rewriting the present. The Bush administration censors public maps and removes information from websites that reveals how Arctic drilling may destroy the environment. And we'll speak to a government scientist terminated for posting the maps. All that and more on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. German anti-nuclear protesters and police have been engaged in a series of confrontations as a train carrying nuclear waste from France approaches a storage site in northern Germany. Thousands of demonstrators are determined to stop the train from delivering the reprocessed nuclear fuel to the site. While the government argues Germany has a moral duty to take back its reprocessed nuclear waste, opponents see disrupting the shipments as the most effective way of forcing an early shutdown of the industry. More than 15,000 police have been deployed, the biggest such operation in Germany's post-war history. The Washington Post is reporting that a week before President Bush broke his campaign pledge to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, Environmental Protection Agency Chief Christine Todd Whitman warned him he must demonstrate his commitment to cutting greenhouse gases or risk undermining the United States' standing among allies around the world. I would strongly recommend you continue to recognize that global warming is a real and serious issue, Whitman said in a memo, a copy of which was obtained by the Washington Post. 1 week later, Bush announced he would not seek a reduction in the carbon dioxide emissions from the nation's power plants. And Russian and Kazakh officials yesterday began pumping crude oil through the first major pipeline to be built in the resource-rich Caspian Sea region in a decade. The $2.6 billion pipeline is operated by the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, which is owned by the governments of Kazakhstan, Oman, and Russia, and eight oil companies, including Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Kerr-McGee of Karen Silkwood fame. And here at home, at 4:30 yesterday morning, six people locked themselves in front of the main door of business offices of five Claremont colleges in California. Soon, 150 students gathered to support them. They say they won't leave until the administration grants their demands. We're joined by two people. Rachel Newman is with us, who is now locked to a concrete barrel blocking the door to Claremont College, and Abigail Singer, a supporter. Rachel Newman, let's begin with you. Can you describe where you are and why you're locked down?
I'm currently located outside the headquarters of Claremont University Center.
Which is where?
It's on the Claremont College's campus, and it's where all of the business for the Claremont Colleges has to go through, and all of the decisions get made for the Claremont Colleges. And this is why we've chosen this building.
And where is Claremont?
Claremont is in the Inland Empire in Los Angeles County, Southern California, and we have a Bernard Biological Field Station, which is one of the last open spaces in L.A. County. And students have used it, biology students have used it, environmental studies students have used it, and currently CUC, Claremont University Center, has plans to allow Keck Graduate Institute to build the first biotechnology graduate school in the entire world on that property. We as students are opposed to this. Most of the faculty is opposed to this, and many members of the Claremont community have been opposed to this. The process, decision-making process, has been completely undemocratic, and we feel that we've tried every way possible, and we've been left out of this decision, and that is why we're locked to the building right now. People are just beginning to wake up, and there should be at least 75 people here at 6 in the morning, and we know that the numbers will just grow as the day continues. This is day two.
Abigail Singer, can you talk about the ties between the biotech research at the university and various corporations?
Well, KGI, which is the Keck Graduate Institute, is the seventh Claremont College, and they have very close ties to industry. They have a corporate roundtable with corporations like Bayer, Genentech, and DuPont, with histories of stolen university research, lots of human rights abuses, environmental destruction all over the Third World, as well as Nazi war crimes. That was Bayer, and they didn't apologize for that until forced to win a lawsuit in 1994. KGI is the immediate threat to the field station. The colleges have been trying to build it on 11 acres of the 86-acre field station. And this is just one of many threats. It looks like they're bending to public pressure a little bit, but the colleges are definitely looking into other things like housing developments and other things that compromise the size of the land.
Rachel Newman, when we say you're locked down, can you describe what does that mean?
Currently, my arm is chained inside of a trash can that is full with 700 to 1,000 pounds of concrete and rocks. Right in front of the front doors, the side doors, and the back doors, we have people.
And how many of you are locked?
What?
How many of you are locked?
There are six of us locked at all times.
And what has been the administration's response at Claremont College?
They issued some random suspension notices with no names on them. They have taken our pictures. We've had campus security watching us all night, and we've had the Claremont Police Department make several visits here. And we have police liaisons who have met with the head of CUC, Claremont University Center, and with the Claremont Police Department chief.
And what are you demanding right now?
We have a contract that we would like Claremont University Center to at least sit down and negotiate with us about, and they haven't even brought up the Bernard Field Station issue with us and refused to talk with us about that at the moment. So today, that is our goal, to get Brendan Barham Hill, the CEO of Claremont University Center, to at least mention the Bernard Biological Field Station.
Rachel Newman and Abigail Singer, two students involved with the protests at the business offices of five Claremont colleges. Thank you for being with us.
We gotta stop the flow of news goo, keeping us drunk on the sugary brew. In the information age, what we lack is information. Just a crew of haircuts and info pretension, with a pun and a smile to hold our attention, like a nation of children. Goo-goo's the intention. We are what we eat, we are what we know, but the information's owned by those who own the show. Control the flow.
More when we return.
Gotta go.
Television watching teaches the same lesson: how to watch without passion, without compassion, without any emotion, as if we all been drugged.
Got news goo.
What we need to know.
News goo.
What we want to know.
We got news.
We
got remote control to choose the show, but the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor, till freedom is a rumor.
News Goo, brought to you by Polarity One, their CD, Yankin' the Food Chain, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, we reported that a newly declassified document exposes the CIA's secret weapon at the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion. Today, we'll talk to journalist John Elliston, the man who unearthed the document in which the CIA boasts that it had, quote, the capability of placing items directly on the wire service tickers as part of its regular propaganda apparatus. It's been long known that during the Cold War, the CIA had a handful of assets or agents in place at news organizations, including the Associated Press and United Press International, particularly in foreign bureaus. The newly declassified document says flatly that the intelligence agency could essentially dictate articles and have them sent around the world. But the CIA used journalists in previously undisclosed ways. We're joined by Jeremy Bigwood as well, who discovered that the CIA was pouring through news photos that he took in Latin America for a major photo agency here in the U.S. and used them as fodder for its intelligence activities. We're going to begin, though, with John Elliston, who's author of Cywar on Cuba, the Declassified History of U.S. Anti-Castro Propaganda. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
Well, explain exactly what it is that you found.
What I found is that in addition to all of the regular propaganda operations that you might expect the CIA to conduct during this massive covert operation, they added from what we can tell from this document, a rather unique operation, and that is an effort to target a world audience as well as the American public by using the wire services, the U.S. wire service, as a propaganda outlet.
Now, what do you mean?
Well, according to this document, the anti-Castro statements that the CIA would be generating through its regular propaganda apparatus would also be placed directly onto U.S. wire services. I can quote from the document. During a period of fighting, this is the time when the agency expected to need most of its propaganda muscle. The agency, through headquarters, can do placement directly on international wire services. In spite of all the elaborate planning to reach the Cuban people and the rest of the world directly, it is the output of the established wire services which most effectively do the job. One report on United Press International, for example, will be repeated on nearly every radio station and most of the newspapers of the Caribbean area, end quote. So then, if the CIA was successful in getting its propaganda line into UPI or AP at the time, then they were able to reach millions of people who were following news of the events in Cuba.
Is there any way that people within the news agencies could not have known that they were relaying these phony stories?
I would anticipate that most of the people working at these news agencies would not be aware of that. However, from the language of this document, it would appear that there were evidently agents in place at major U.S. Wire services, people who were willing to collaborate with the agency, perhaps on a contractual basis, to spread the agency's rumors and disinformation.
Can you talk about the dangers of, I mean, we know through, since, you know, World War II, that the Central Intelligence Agency did have people at news agencies or newspapers, especially foreign sites. The dangers that this means for actual journalists.
Sure, Amy. Well, it taints the profession in ways that are hard to gauge, but particularly looking back on it, we realize that much of the news that appeared even on our very own domestic newspapers during covert operations like this may have been tainted by the agency's agenda. The agency has always warned about the possibility of blowback, that is, the term they use for propaganda that they disseminate abroad that inadvertently makes its way back into the U.S. press. Here we have something more extreme and more dangerous, I think, the direct placement of CIA propaganda in the U.S. press without even circumventing it through a foreign outlet first.
We're also joined on the telephone by Jeremy Bigwood, who is a journalist and researcher. How did you find out that the CIA was looking through your photos?
Basically, it's a very long story. It started with me receiving a check for a missing slide from the State Department through my photo agency. And I just wondered, I'd been taking pictures in El Salvador. I was there for about 6 years during the war. And I just wondered what the State Department was doing looking at my stuff. So I went to my photo agency, which is a New York and Paris-based photo agency, and I looked through all of my material and found that all of my material and all of the material of the photographers who had preceded me, one of them was John Hoagland, who was killed in combat, had all been checked out by supposedly the State Department. And that set off some alarm bells, and I told my photo agency immediately that this was very bad news for a journalist, because I tried to portray myself as absolutely neutral in the field in El Salvador. And I've been asked by guerrillas, by people even on the right, if I worked for the CIA. And I'd always said, no, I was a journalist, and my photo agency would only sell to journalists, to major media. But what happened is this problem remained with me, and I started checking it out more. My original complaints resulted in a Small Village Voice article about it, and my photo agency promised not to let my photographs be used anymore. But other photographers, their photographs were still being used. And after about 6 years, I was able to determine that it was not the State Department who was actually in receipt of the photographs, but the Central Intelligence Agency.
How did you find that out?
Basically, I knew the name of the person actually picking up the photographs from the photo agencies in the name of the State Department, and they pay with Treasury Department checks just like the Central Intelligence Agency would. And the State Department had absolutely no record of her. And when I asked the CIA through the FOIA,
Freedom of Information Act,
when I asked them about individual photographs about her, et cetera, I got that the information was being withheld because of sources and methods, which means they essentially admitted to having copies of the photographs.
What were you taking pictures of, Jeremy Bigwood?
Well, I was going out, I was covering a war, and it was a war between essentially a U.S.-backed government and a leftist insurgency. So I was taking pictures. I had a reputation for being out in the country a lot and taking pictures of campesinos. And my greatest fear was that the sequential photographs that I had taken could actually be used to identify peasants who were sympathetic to guerrillas for to be eliminated by death squads. And that was my original fear.
Can you say what photo agency you worked for?
No.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this was common practice?
Oh, I know it was common practice. Not all, but many of the photo agencies used to do this. At the present time, things are being done a little bit differently because there's so much use of digital photographs. So instead of sending your undeveloped rolls of film up, usually now you're sending an edited digital picture, which has a lot less information. But there is still ties between, there's still a lot of ties between the Central Intelligence Agency and the press. We were just talking about the wire services. The wire services are indeed have the Central Intelligence Agency as a client, with many of the attributes of just being a newspaper. In other words, anything that's done for the wire services goes immediately to the Central Intelligence Agency, and there are connections between journalists in the field still and agents, and there's a fair amount of interplay that goes on with trading of information. It's still going on.
Can you be more specific about that, the relationship between journalists in the field and CIA agents?
Well, it's very hard to be very broad. I know of a few cases of journalists who have relationships with the Central Intelligence Agency because I've been studying this for a very long time. I know of a few cases where they debrief, either for money or not for money, the representatives of the Central Intelligence Agency. There are also cases of the Central Intelligence officers posing as journalists in very isolated cases, but it has happened. For instance, it happened during the offensive in El Salvador in 1989. Essentially, the CIA is not doing, appears to me that the CIA is not doing this as much as it used to, but it is still doing this.
John Elliston, you were just down in Cuba where you released the information on the ability of the CIA to actually place items directly on the wire service tickers at a major conference. Was there a former CIA director there?
We had with us at the conference two former CIA officers. One was a man who was the station chief in Miami during the months preceding and following the invasion, and indeed during the invasion. And in addition, we had a CIA officer who worked on post-Bay of Pigs covert operations against the Castro government, which is to say in the 2 or 3 years following the invasion that sabotage continued and other covert operations.
And was Castor at the conference?
He was indeed.
Uh-huh.
And was somewhat chummy with these gentlemen, considering their history.
So what's going on?
It was a remarkable exchange.
What's going on? What was the exchange?
Well, everyone came to the conference with the intention of offering up as much of the past as they could in the form of documents and memories, and trying to reconcile their differences historically and to expand on the record of this crucial episode in the Cold War. And in that, I think we were successful.
We're talking to John Elliston and Jeremy Bigwood. John Elliston, a reporter, Jeremy Bigwood, a reporter and a photographer who came to understand that his photographs were being taken by and used, scrutinized by the Central Intelligence Agency. We'll be back with them in a minute, and then we're going to look at how the Bush administration is rewriting the present, how they are removing information from websites that show that oil drilling could have a destructive effect on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to two reporters, Jeremy Bigwood and John Elliston. John Elliston just came back from Havana, where he was at a major conference dealing with the declassification of documents around the Bay of Pigs invasion. Very briefly, John Elliston, for those who were not around then, our younger listeners, explain what happened in the Bay of Pigs and why the propaganda was so essential to the invasion.
Absolutely. This operation occurred in April 1961. It was very early in the Kennedy administration, just 3 months into it. The operation came along at the heyday of the CIA's power and at the heyday of the CIA's global propaganda apparatus. And in the course of trying to invade and overthrow revolutionary Cuba with a force of Cuban exiles, the agency flexed its propaganda muscle. It employed every means at its disposal to try to tinker with and alter public opinion, not only within Cuba, but indeed throughout the hemisphere, throughout the world, and even within U.S. borders. The idea being that whatever U.S. moves were afoot against Cuba, they might be better supported if the climate of opinion, we could say, globally favored the agency's line.
At least one operation that was revived by the Reagan administration in 1985, going back to the propaganda operations of the 60s, was Radio Cayman, a clandestine station aimed at young Cubans. And it supposedly was ended by the Clinton administration in 1994, as well as some other CIA operations aimed at Cuba. Could you explain what that was?
Yes, this station, actually Radio Cayman in Spanish, was a unique CIA venture in that it targeted young people exclusively. Those folks who managed to hear the station, and I did not, it was a clandestine station evidently operating from Guatemala, but on shortwave so as to reach Cuba. They tell me that the station included such things as popular music and wry commentary and jokes about the Cuban situation. And it was evidently an attempt to draw in a younger generations of Cubans to supporting the United States agenda within Cuba.
I mean, I think a lot of this is interesting now. We have another story not exactly related to do with Russian so-called spies and diplomats being thrown out of the country, and questions about whether with so many cold warriors in the new Bush administration that harken back from the old Bush-Reagan years, if a lot of the tensions are being drummed up because this is the environment they feel comfortable in, the Bush administration officials, and if we're going to see the same thing with Cuba, though you're describing quite a friendly relationship between the CIA agents and Castro at this meeting.
These are former officers, though, mind you, and I think we do have very good reason to be wary with this incoming administration, particularly in the field of Latin American affairs. The Bush administration has nominated Otto Reich for its top post at the State Department to handle the Latin American affairs, and he is a veteran of the Reagan administration, and his handiwork there that he is most known for running what was called the Office of Public Diplomacy, which supported the Contra War and other controversial Reagan initiatives by conducting what were essentially domestic propaganda operations, attempts to pressure the U.S. media, attempts to chase reporters off stories, attempts to place editorials in U.S. newspapers supporting the Contra War, and the like. Much of this came out during the Iran-Contra investigations, and this is, as I say, how Mr. Reich became somewhat notorious for those of us who are worried about domestic propaganda, and that's why many folks, I'm sure, will do what they can to block the nomination.
On this issue of how using journalists for intelligence gathering, or CIA agents themselves as journalists, endangers actual journalists, since what they do is very similar in terms of going out in the field and gathering intelligence. How dangerous does this make it for journalists, Jeremy Bigwood, in undermining their credibility? The CIA might have two benefits from doing this. One is they get information, but two is they discredit real journalists.
Right. Basically, it can mean a matter of life and death. Journalists have been killed in foreign countries for being spies. Whether or not they really were, in many cases you don't really know. But in some cases they might have been, and this adds a certain amount of risk. In a case like my case, there's also an incredible risk for the people that you're photographing and perhaps interviewing. You have to take that into consideration.
But that's also true with the pub. I mean, you publish your photographs, so anyone
right,
can look at that.
Right, right. But in my case, it was looking at the entire rolls. You're only publishing one photograph or two photographs of an event, and not the whole. If you look at if you're gathering intelligence, the whole unedited film is far more important to you.
And finally, in both your cases, how hard was it to get this information, Jeremy Bigwood?
Incredibly hard. I spent 12 years on this and 6 years through the Freedom of Information Act. And only a couple of months ago did I get the final response from the State Department, which allowed me to proceed. I'm publishing this in the American Journalism Review in the June issue.
And John Elliston.
And in my case, it also took years of effort to track down particularly materials like this, which I believe the agency considered to be especially sensitive given the nature of the operations that this document describes. Those of us who research covert operations against Cuba have been in luck, however, during recent years. The Assassination Records Review Board that was created by Congress to declassify Kennedy assassination-related materials churned up literally millions of pages of documents regarding operations against Cuba and other topics that touched on the assassination. And within those papers were a great many disclosures about propaganda operations and the like against Cuba. But then Freedom of Information Act requests have also been fruitful. They simply do take years to play out.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. John Elliston, author of Psywar on Cuba, which stands short for Psychological War, Psywar on Cuba, the Declassified History of U.S. Anti-Castro Propaganda, published by Ocean Press, and Jeremy Bigwood, journalist, researcher, and photographer, recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, now based in Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on to some more information that's being wiped off of websites. As we speak, some administrations destroy paper trails, some rewrite the past, a few rewrite the present. The Bush administration is doing all three. It's removed information on Fish and Game Department's public website, concluding that oil drilling at the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will, quote, destroy, disrupt, diminish, and damage the environment and wildlife in the region. The Bush administration also has ordered the removal of maps from the internet that documented the migratory patterns of Arctic caribou. It then terminated the scientist who compiled and posted the information, which would have helped environmentalists show the impact of oil drilling. This is an email by Ian Thomas, the scientist who posted the map. He writes, quote, I'm handing in my government keys on Monday, all for a tiny map the size of a postcard showing where baby caribou like to hang out. Pretty amazing. I'm pissed off. I think this is plain and simple censorship of a fundamental right for free public debate and access to information. And God knows what happens to any federal scientist working in Alaska who says anything against the party line. As of tomorrow, I'm on an enforced leave and at home. We're joined on the telephone now by Ian Thomas, who wrote that email, former mapping specialist at U.S. Geological Survey, fired on the 12th of March. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello there.
It's good to have you with us. Explain the significance of the map that you drew and how it got removed.
The map came from data I got from public websites. My job was to support scientists in my agency. It's the Biological Resources Division, and I collected any information that would be useful for national wildlife refuges, for mapping birds, and any other biodiversity. The map of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, showing where the caribou was, it was only just one of several thousand maps that I'd put up on the internet. I was actually very, very surprised when they fired me because I posted it to the internet. The week before, I had made over 2,000 maps of national parks and nature reserves, and the map of the where the caribou was in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was just one of the things that I thought I was supposed to be doing for my job. And my job was to make the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, look good, collect data for scientists, get the information out to the public, and specifically to help national wildlife refuges, to provide information for refuge managers, I'm really amazed about what happened. My timing was very bad. I sent out my map, and as soon as I put it on the internet, I put over 20,000 maps on the internet. As soon as I did that, I have an email list where I can email everyone who makes maps in my agency. And I said, look, I've made this nice, pretty map, plus I've made all these other maps of national wildlife refuges. I just assumed that if there was any problem with the map, then I would have, there would be some feedback, and I could remove the map. And
Can you explain what the significance of the map is?
Well,
Bush administration would be concerned about it.
Well, when I made the map, I didn't actually know if there was any if it was pro oil development or bad for oil development. All I did was take the existing information that was available and make a prettier map from it. I didn't really know where they wanted to drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I was just looking at the the distribution of the animals and looking at the vegetation and a satellite image of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And I was trying to make that information available to the public and available to other people in my agency. Unfortunately, what happened was when I announced this my new map, I told other people in my agency, and it was just at the same time as the people in Alaska who have been working on the caribou have 2 years of new data, and they were in the process of a very important meeting with the Secretary of the Interior, Gail Norden, and where they were telling her about new distributions of caribou data and presenting the last 2 years of research. That information isn't public yet. I have no access to it. I'm trying to get access to it now. And so during that, I think what happened was during that important meeting where they were presenting this new distribution data, all of a sudden they get an email from me, and I was based in a little wildlife refuge in Maryland, and someone saw the maps that I just made and really overreacted very badly. When I came to work on the following morning, I was fired almost immediately. I didn't even have time to write down what had happened and anything.
The Secretary of the Interior, Gail Norden, was at that meeting?
I think the decision to terminate me was taken at a very high level within the Department of Interior. I've been told that on the weekend, on the weekend there were phone calls made to the place where I worked, where the phone call was from the head of the Biological Resources Division and the head of the Eastern Region of the United States Geological Survey. And I'm at the bottom of the totem pole. I was a contractor working at United States Geological Survey. I have very little legal comeback because I was a contractor. They terminated my contract. If I was a federal employee, I would be suing at this stage.
What about the information, which leads to a very important question about websites now, the lack of a paper trail?
To
be able to get the maps that have now been taken down from the website.
I'm on a very fast learning curve here. I really didn't realize that this was going on, but since then, there's been a lot of other information removed from federal web pages that people have told me about now, and it's scientific information that might not be agreeable to the people who are making the decisions now. And so Defenders of Wildlife, which is a great group here in Washington, D.C., they've documented many changes that have just been made to federal websites where information that would be against oil development has been removed from the website. And I've actually noticed information like that now just disappear. It's very worrying that that's happening.
For a little background on who Gail Norden is, the new Secretary of the Interior under Bush, looking at a counterpunch issue that's put out by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair of December, January. It reminds us that Norden in 1983 followed James Watt to Reagan's Interior Department. She remained there even after James Watt was booted back to Colorado in disgrace. In the solicitor's office, Norden plotted to undo the Endangered Species Act, open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil companies, abet strip miners along the Rocky Mountain front, and eviscerate wetlands protection. There was a great deal of concern about her being nominated to the head of the Department of Interior, but then she pretty much sailed through. And now we see some of the effects of her very early tenure. When we come back from our break, we're going to look, along with Ian Thomas, at information that has been removed from the Fish and Game Department's public website that does conclude that oil drilling in the Arctic Refuge could destroy the environment and wildlife in the region. Ian Thomas, again, just had his contract terminated. He is a former mapping specialist at U.S. Geological Survey for posting a map, one of 20,000 that he's posted, that showed where baby caribou hang out in the Arctic and how they might be affected by Arctic drilling. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at how the Bush administration is rewriting the present, we're talking to Ian Thomas, former mapping specialist at U.S. Geological Survey. And we're now joined by Bob Ferris, who is vice president for species conservation at the Defenders of Wildlife in Washington, D.C. Bob Ferris, what did the Bush administration do to website information about the Arctic Reserve?
Well, in my view, they looked at polling data and then scrubbed everything out of the site that disagreed with polling data. They've been trying to keep things on message, and anything that was in the site that disagreed with that message, that they can go in there and drill in a responsible manner with minimum impacts, was taken out of there.
Well, explain what happened to the Fish and Game Department's public website.
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Service's website had either information removed or information added that changed the character of many of the comments. I think the one example that strikes me as most important, though there are a lot of them, is the information dealing with ice roads. President Bush has made a big point out of talking about going into the refuge during winter. They make ice roads, pump water up there, and are able to drive on the ice and have little or no damage in the area. And a lot of people have bought into that scenario. The problem is that when you look at the data that posted on the website, there's not enough water in there to make the roads that he's talking about. There's somewhere around 9 million gallons of water, somewhere around there, that and that would only make around 8 miles of roads, and this is an area that's about 150 miles long. So the rest of the roads would have to be made out of gravel or other materials, and certainly that would have an impact on the refuge.
I'm just looking at some of the information that's been taken down from the Fish and Wildlife Service's public website. I just learned a new term, that you vacuumed the site.
Right.
Right, that you copied it. And it's very interesting because people think, oh, I can always go back to a website and get information. But just some of the wording that was taken down, this was removed, that oil drilling would destroy the unique wildland values of a world-class natural area, disrupt ecological and evolutionary processes in one of the most pristine conservation areas in the North America Arctic, diminish the refuge's scientific value as a benchmark for understanding these processes, and damage the biological and ecological integrity of the entire refuge. And then there's another paragraph. This part stays in. 135 species of birds are known to use a particular area, including numerous shorebirds, waterfowl, loons, songbirds, and raptors. And this is taken out. Oil development in the Arctic Refuge would result in habitat loss, disturbance, and displacement or abandonment of important nesting, feeding, molting, and staging areas. So what do you do? And have you reposted this on your own website?
Well, we vacuumed the site in December because we anticipated that there'd be major changes in the site. And this is copyright-free material, so any citizen, it's legal for them to do this. And then we posted it on a site, www.savearcticrefuge.org, so that anybody can view what's out there now and then compare it to what's on the Fish and Wildlife Service site now.
Ian Thomas, we were just talking about the caribou and how a little map about the caribou could be a key to perhaps unraveling the plans to drill in the Arctic, but now that map is down. What about the caribou's significance for the indigenous people who live there?
Well, actually, first of all, I've managed to get a copy of the map that got me fired, and I put up my own website just to make sure that the public has access to the information still. And so if people want to go and see the map, it's www.maptricks.com. So it's like card tricks, but instead it's called map tricks.
T-R-I-C-K.
M-A-P-T-R-I-C-K-S.
Mm-hmm.
When I had a lot of research interests that overlap with caribou, and not only was I supporting national wildlife refuges and with providing maps for national wildlife refuges, one of my main tasks was to work on migratory birds, and caribou are migratory animals, and it's very interesting to see how mapping techniques that work for birds can be applied to other animals. The other thing that I've been involved in recently is I had a very serious proposal that was to internal to the United States Geological Survey. It was to look at the effects of mineral extraction on biodiversity in Africa and in North America. And this proposal was co-signed by the head of the Mineral Division of the United States Geological Survey. So the United States Geological Survey knew what my research was. They were happy that I was doing it until all of a sudden this came out of the blue, and I'm fired. But
and what about the Gwich'in and how this affects?
Yeah, on the website I put up, I have very strong views about what should be done in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But on the website, I just simply put up the maps and I said how I made the maps and where I got them from. But if you want to know my views on what's going on, it's really I look at if we're not careful with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it really represents one of the last great animal migrations on the planet. The buffalo no longer exist. The porcupine caribou herd is 100,000s of animals. There's not very many places left in the world where that happens. And maybe the Serengeti in Africa. But the problem is that if you look at protected areas and biodiversity hotspots around the world, and the reason they're still there is often they're isolated. Unfortunately, they're also sitting on top of other mineral resources, whether it's gold, diamonds, and oil. And if we can't show a good example in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, then I don't see how we can come and tell any other country not to look after its protected areas and biodiversity. And at the same time, we go around the world criticizing countries for, you know, not looking after indigenous groups. And It's so amazing. The Gwich'in Nation, the Native Americans who live up there with the caribou, they could make so much money by saying, it's okay, go ahead, drill. But instead they're fighting this, and I hope everyone supports them. It's really important.
I'd like to put these stories into a larger context of government employees, or in your case, a contractor for the government, that just continue to do their work until they get fired for it. We're also joined by Eric Wingeter, who is Field Director for Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, which basically is a group that helps whistleblowers within the government. How do you help public employees employees who want to reveal information but are afraid to go public? And what kind of cases have you documented of people like Ian Thomas, who just lost his job for putting up what he thought was a routine map?
Yeah, good morning, Amy. We got our start about 7 years ago working with almost exclusively whistleblowers. But what we've been seeing in the past few years, more cases like Ian. Ian's not a whistleblower. Ian was fired for simply doing his job. We're calling it an accidental profile in courage. He never meant to put his name out there, put his job on the line, certainly. He's just a scientist that posted information, and through the course of trying to do his job right, he was punished for it. At the state and federal level, it seems to be more and more common as sound science and biology is being set aside in favor of politics. One of the things that we try and do at PEER is provide an anonymous voice for public employees on the state and the state level and the federal level. For employees that don't want to get fired for their jobs, obviously it's in the best interests of the environment and the best interests of the employees that the good, sound scientists continue to work for these agencies and stay on the inside. So we often put our name or our letterhead on anonymous letters that are actually written by insiders within the agency. So we'll publish, for example, white papers that document patterns of malfeasance or violations of law within federal agencies. That way, we can work with the media to get the story out at the same time protecting the employees that are continuing to do the science on the inside.
Let's talk about the examples of Montana and Maine. In Montana, the tales of sludge.
Yeah. Tales of Sludge, it was a white paper written by employees at the wastewater treatment plant in the city of Missoula. Not only were the water quality testing requirements of the Clean Water Act being ignored, plant managers were actually threatening to retaliate against city employees who did the testing properly. The idea behind this was if they could show that they had no violations of the Clean Water Act, they wouldn't get in trouble with the state or the federal government. So instead, they just suppressed the findings that ran contrary to the Clean Water Act. We released this document, this white paper, about 4 or 5 months ago to a fairly good public fanfare around the state. Unfortunately, at the time, the mayor of Missoula had promised to do something about it, and nothing's happened. So 2 weeks ago, we just issued a 60-day notice of intent to sue the city of Missoula and force it to comply with the Clean Water Act.
And what about Maine, the Allegash Wilderness?
Yeah, the Allegash Wilderness Waterway is an amazing stretch of land in northern Maine. Our director of Maine Pier, his name is Tim Caverly, was the manager of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway for about 18 years. But 2 years ago, he was forced out when the legislature was sort of putting the screws in the Bureau of Parks and Land when development pressure got a little too hot in northern Maine. So with Tim's help, he recruited a number of current and former employees that continue to work for the Bureau of Public Lands to issue another white paper, we call it Losing Paradise, to document the pattern of political interference along this stretch of water.
In New Mexico, you also have been helping people within the government at the Department of Fish and Game.
Right. We were approached a year ago from a number of employees in the Department of Fish and Game, and we employed a tactic that has been helpful around the country in different agencies. We worked with current employees to draft a survey asking about general issues like morale, budget problems, things that seem to be common in a number of state agencies, but also asking about interference from the governor's office or interference from the State Game Commission in the scientific day-to-day decision-making of the employees. And the results, unfortunately, were not surprising. More than two-thirds of the employees stated that they doubted that their own management will stand up to special interests or political pressure. An additional two-thirds said that the State Game Commission, these are appointees of the governor's office, were inappropriately interfering in staff science. And really significantly, one in five of the respondents said that they had been directed or encouraged directly by a supervisor to specifically ignore threats to wildlife or environmental law. Now, the surveys provide an interesting way to get this message out, but to protect the anonymity of employees. They offer collective voice to every employee in the state. Nobody has to fear that by talking about their own personal examples, they're going to face retaliation, the kind of retaliation that Ian found from USGS.
So what kind of protection do workers have?
Well, it depends on the state that they live in. It depends whether they're working for a federal agency or a state agency. Unfortunately, in Ian's situation, he had very little legal protection because he was a contract employee. On paper, federal career service employees have protections under the Whistleblower Protection Act. But again, Ian likely would not have been protected. The Whistleblower Protection Act on the federal level is set up to protect victims of waste, fraud, and abuse. What Ian did, like I said earlier, he wasn't a whistleblower. He was just simply doing his job.
If people want to get in touch with PEER, mm-hmm. with your group, the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, where can they call?
They can give me a call at my office at area code 202-265-7337. And I'd also encourage folks to check out our website. It's www.peer.org.
That's 202-265-7337. You can check out all these contact information on the website, webactive.com, where you can hear Democracy Now! Online. Finally, tomorrow, we're going to be looking at a case that's going to court today in Washington, a trial of a of an Indonesian general who was involved with the raising of the country of East Timor, the rampages conducted by the Indonesian military and militias after the referendum vote for independence, August 30th, 1999. And I thought it was interesting, Ian Thomas, just another story that you have been involved in is the mapping of East Timor after the independence vote and what happened to the country.
Yeah, I had a friend who was an election monitor who went to East Timor, and so as something I really believed in, I tried to make maps of East Timor and to help the UN.
And what happened to the infrastructure and the people where they were?
Well, it's there are.
That's what you were mapping.
Yeah, one of the things that. That occurred during East Timor when the bloodletting and the massacres began. There were fires set in the towns, and it was actually an Australian weather station that picked up all these fires appearing on their satellite images. And so one of the things that I managed to obtain with World Watch Institute was a picture of Dili burning, where you can see the fires and the actual houses which were burning in the photograph.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Ian Thomas, former mapping specialist at U.S. Geological Survey, as well Eric Wingeter of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, and Bob Ferris, Vice President for Species Conservation. Again, tomorrow we are going to take a look at the case of General Johnny Lumentang. He was served with papers last year when he was leaving an airport in the United States going back to Indonesia, and now he is being brought to a civil trial charging him with crimes against humanity and gross violation of human rights. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, and by the way, a lot of people called for the Alice Walker interview yesterday, you can call the archives for a copy at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We'd love to hear how you feel. Our producers today, Terry Allen and Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!